'Tis the season for the various renderings of A Christmas Carol by Charles Dickens. This year there is the animated version, which you can enjoy in 3D. Or if you're more inclined toward the traditional, there are assorted audio readings, such as this one by the late British actor Paul Scofield.
Once upon a time of all the good days in the year, on Christmas Eve, old Scrooge sat busy in his counting house.
Dickens himself used to perform A Christmas Carol, but as NPR's Margot Adler reports, he didn't perform it as he had written it.
If you walk into the New York Public Library during this holiday season, you can look into a small glass case on the third floor in the reading room. Isaac Gewurz, the curator of the Berg Collection of English and American Literature, explains.
The most prominent item in the case is the prompt book of Charles Dickens for A Christmas Carol.
And what's a prompt book?
A prompt book is a book that prompts the reader on giving a performed reading of a text. In Dickens' day, public readings of fiction or of poetry was not done. It was considered a desecration of one's art and a lowering of one's dignity.
But forget about dignity. Charles Dickens, according to Gewurz, gave perhaps 150 public readings of A Christmas Carol over his lifetime. The first one went as long as 3 hours. Later versions took about an hour and 25 minutes. And when you look at the prompt book, he cut out a lot. Complex sentences were replaced with simple ones.
What's interesting, though, is to see how much of the atmospherics have been deleted. Scenes that set the mood in the streets of London, for instance.
And often anything to do with the state of mind of a character that could be conveyed by tone of voice.
You will notice that in the right-hand margin to this page there, it says tone to pathos. So you have many of these kinds of cues to himself, how to modulate his voice, what kind of emotion to convey at the time.
So those classic renditions of Dickens, like the one by Paul Scofield here?
Come then, returned the nephew gaily. What right have you to be dismal? What reason have you to be morose? You're rich enough. Scrooge, having no better answer ready on the spur of the moment, said bah again and followed it up with humbug.
Be advised, they may not be as traditional as you think. Dickens himself changed Dickens. Margot Adler, NPR News, New York.
And you can see the edits in A Christmas Carol in Dickens' own handwriting at npr.org.
Dr. Anne Dunham Sutoro didn't live long enough to see her famous son forge his place in American history. President Barack Obama's mother died in 1995 at the age of 52 after a battle with ovarian cancer. In the updated version of his memoir, Dreams from My Father, the president spoke movingly about the last decade of her life.
She had spent the previous 10 years doing what she loved. She traveled the world, working in the distant villages of Asia and Africa, helping women buy a sewing machine or a milk cow or an education that might give them a foothold in the world's economy. She wrote reports, read novels, pestered her children, and dreamed of grandchildren.
That's President Obama reading from his memoir, Dreams from My Father. His mother, Anne Dunham, was an anthropologist. Her fieldwork focused on the small craftsmen in a village in Indonesia. Now, nearly two decades after she submitted her dissertation, Anne Dunham's fieldwork has been published, a fulfillment of her dream. The book is called Surviving Against the Odds, and Anne Dunham's daughter and President Obama's sister, Maya Sutoro Ng, was the engine behind its publication, and Maya Sutoro Ng joins me in the studio. Thank you for being here.
Thank you, Guy. It's a pleasure to be here.
Your mom's research centered around one small village, Kajar, on the island of Java, in Indonesia. Describe what she was trying to find out.
Well, Mom actually started out by looking at a number of different cottage industries. Her hypothesis was that in a time when people were looking at primarily wet rice cultivation, when thinking about the economic development and stability of Indonesia, that there were a lot of cottage industries that were actually indispensable. So she started off by looking at batik and tile making and weaving, and ultimately she decided to go with blacksmithing. And the village of Kajar is a blacksmithing village. It interested her, I think, because there were both utilitarian implement being forged there, but also the Indonesian sacred dagger, the keris, which very often has a serpentine blade and has a rich cultural history and a significant place in the Javanese cosmos.
Your mom was a classic field anthropologist. And I gather, I mean, you were a child through much of the time when she was doing this research in Indonesia. I gather at times you went into the field with her. Do you remember any sort of specific encounters?
I remember many specific encounters. I remember a lot of meals shared. I remember the ritual of taking tea. I remember time spent walking to the rivers. There is a part of her dissertation when she talks about the sort of sacred river, the bottom of which is this flat stone. And on the stone, you see the image of a dagger, the keris, that is there basically as a result of natural color variations. And of course, the people of Qajar say that that is, you know, it's basically a divine blessing, that sort of thing. But I remember walking to this river, and recently I thought, wow, it would be so wonderful to be able to go back to that river if ever I could find it again and try to find that flat stone. But the dissertation is wonderful because you really can picture it all.
I know you and your brother, the president, were very close to your mother. Did it stir up a lot of emotions? I mean, it's a dissertation about, you know, this kind of esoteric topic. But did it, in a sense, stir up some emotions reading it?
Well, I mean, I think we both are so sad that she's not with us. I have two daughters, and obviously the president also has two daughters. She really wanted grandchildren. She was never able to meet them. And certainly the dissertation brought up emotions. I wish she had known that others would have the ability to read her work and to consider her suggestions. But, of course, a lot of things have transpired in the last couple of years that have made me feel like it would have been nice to have her. More than nice. It would have been wonderful.
What do you think your mom would have made of your success and your brother's success? She was, by and large, a single parent. I mean, the odds, the deck was stacked against you and your brother. You went on to achieve a PhD in education. Your brother is the president of the United States. What would your mom have made of that?
You know, I don't know. She didn't necessarily anticipate, who could have, that her son would become president of the United States. But she knew that he was going to do remarkable things. And that comforts me, actually. I mean, when she died, I'm pretty sure that she was aware that he was going to be okay. And I think more than that, he showed her, in ways large and small, that he was interested in making the world better, that he was committed to the kind of service that she encouraged all of her life. And she also could see how charismatic he was and what a capable individual and leader he was.
You think it would have been strange for, I mean, somebody like your mom, who was so far removed from the corridors of power, who was so connected to people on the ground in a really direct way, to see that happen?
Yeah, that is interesting that you know, she spent time with people who were very, very poor. And she didn't reside in those corridors of power. But certainly the pageantry and the processes of being president would have held some anthropological interest for her.
Maya Sutoro Ng is the daughter of Ann Dunham and the sister of President Barack Obama. She's just helped publish her late mother's doctoral dissertation. It's called Surviving Against the Odds. Maya Sutoro Ng, thank you for sharing the story of your remarkable mom.
Thank you, Guy.
And you can read an excerpt from Ann Dunham's book about what happened when the village she studied got its first television set. It's on our website, npr.org. Thank you.
This year's other Nobel Prizes were awarded today in Stockholm, and we have a review now of the first book published by the winner of the Nobel Literature Prize. She's Herta Mueller, a German born in Romania. Here's our reviewer, Alan Chews.
Nadir's is a slim volume, but packed with a powerfully resonant series of short takes on Mueller's childhood in the German-speaking region of Romania. All of the overwhelming details of childhood tumble through the pages of her extraordinary recreation of her early life in a small village. Her mastery of image and the sensations is so sharp, I found myself, despite the book's brevity, unable to read more than a few pages, sometimes just a few paragraphs in a single sitting. Mueller leaps from the real to the fantastic in the middle of a sentence, as when she describes how summer night falls on her village. "I never understood how this happened," she says. "Every night the summer drowned carelessly in the middle of the village." Or when she writes about bathing. "When my skin got dry," she says, "it tightened and felt like glass. My whole body felt how I was getting beautiful, and I stepped carefully not to break apart. My gait had something of my grandmother's starched linen. When I slept in it the first night, it rustled with any move, and I believed my skin was rustling." The world of the village, as Mueller celebrates it, rustles on these pages. Each line, each paragraph, such a wedding of insight in the fantastic that I could scarcely hold the book without trembling.
The book is called Nadir's by this year's Nobel laureate in literature, Herta Mueller. Our reviewer is Alan Chews. Suppose a 300-year-old black man had decided, say when he was about 10, to keep a scrapbook, a record of what it was like for himself and his people in these United States. So began the introduction written by Bill Cosby to a book published 35 years ago. It was called The Black Book, and it was indeed like a scrapbook of the African-American experience. Flip through the pages and you'd find advertisements for the public sale of Negroes and Piccaninny Children and advertisements for spool cotton and sunlight soap. You'd also find families dressed in their Sunday finest and soldiers who helped break the color barrier in the U.S. military. The book was the first of its kind, a breakthrough and a New York Times bestseller, and now it's been republished in a 35th anniversary edition. Toni Morrison helped compile the original Black Book, and she joins us now to talk about the reissue. Welcome to the program.
Thank you.
Let's put this in context, because this was 1974. This was before the TV miniseries Roots.
Yes.
This was before the age of Google. These were images that weren't in history books. They were not widely available to people.
Not at all. That's why the authors are these collectors. The head man, Spike Harris, Middleton A. Harris, was a collector. And I would go into his apartment, stacks and stacks of newspapers, 19th century newspapers, buttons from all sorts of causes, and just memorabilia everywhere.
Toward the beginning of the book, some of the pictures are really gruesome. The men hanging from trees, the charred body of a man. And in that picture, as disturbing as the picture of a man burning is, what's even more jarring is the picture of the men in the background, white men with straw hats who are smiling or looking on in a rather nonchalant fashion. Was there any debate over whether or not to include images like this in the book?
No, I had complete control. I don't think
why was it necessary for people to see this?
Well, lynchings were not merely punishments, whether accurate or, you know, deserved. Most of them were not. But there were carnival aspects to it. People gathered around to see. They sold tickets. They brought their children, and they had picnics. It was not entirely unlike what went on with hangings in Europe and in other countries. But the fact of the matter is that this was not understood to be, you know, in addition to the law, which was arbitrary and passionate, it was also festive. But these were human beings. And so many of those kinds of deaths were not just unjust, often stories of some crime or infringement were circulated about Negroes who had property or who had jobs that local whites wanted. I know that my father's little village in Georgia had two such lynchings that he witnessed as a young boy, and they were both men who were lynched because they had a little store or job that someone locally wanted.
When you were putting this together, you were an editor at Random House back then. Mm-hmm. Did Random House know what you were cooking up here?
Yeah. They knew some things. They knew what I wanted to do. They thought it was a good idea. I had heard from the sales department that it was difficult. I was interested in publishing unknown African-American writers, and they weren't selling very well. And I was told that it was very difficult to sell African-American authors, as they put it, across the street, meaning there was a kind of readership that was not large in the black community. So I thought, well, maybe we haven't published anything that the large African-American community wanted. Maybe not this novel or this collection of poetry, etc., but what about something that's really popular and is about African-American life? And that's when I began to put it together, and I didn't have a manuscript. That was a little... It made them uneasy, I think, because it was so manuscript. All I had were these pictures and newspaper clippings and sheet music and postcards. You know, it was like, you know, a jumble. And they didn't quite know.
But it does flow one into the other. They really do tell a story.
Yeah, we put together very, very nicely.
I want to ask you about the patents. There's a large section of very detailed drawings. These are patents from African-American inventors, I guess, at the time, though they wouldn't be calling them African-American, would they?
Not then,
the parlance, I guess, would be Negro.
Yes.
Inventors. And their patents for a clothes dryer and an airship and a fountain pen and the improvement in sugar making and a typewriting machine. And there's several pages of this. Yeah. Why was that important?
To show that African-Americans were, busy, smart, and not just, you know, menstrualized. I remember my mother used to say, do you know that a Negro invented shoes? And I said, Mama, everybody invented shoes. How could you not think up how to cover your feet? But when I was doing this book, I saw a shoe lasting machine. You know how to...
I'm actually looking at it right now. I think it's on page 116, if that's what you're talking about.
Yes, yeah. Yes, there it is. And so she was sort of right. She said shoes, but she meant, you know, something to make it possible, you know, to get the sole and the heel and so on, mechanized and so on. That was fascinating to me.
You include in the 35th anniversary edition a letter written by a prison inmate. Why don't you tell me about that?
I used to get letters from prisoners who wanted books or freedom or money or clothes. But this one was quite different. My recollection is exactly this. Dear Mrs. Morrison, someone sent me a copy of the Black Book. And if at all possible, I would like to have two more. I need one copy to give to a friend, another to throw against the wall, over and over and over. The one I already own, I want to hold in my arms against my heart.
Well, there it is. That sums up so many of the reactions you have when you read this book. Because there are moments where your stomach churns, and there are moments where the book just shimmers with pride. And there are things that make you want to holler.
True.
Toni Morrison, it is always a pleasure to talk to you. I could go on all day.
Thank you.
That's writer and Nobel laureate Toni Morrison. She compiled the Black Book as an editor at Random House. It's just been re-released to mark its 35th anniversary.